give me a kiss to build a dream on. And my imagination will thrive upon that kiss.
It is 6:06 on the Central Coast on this Monday, January 20th, 2020. I'm Dave Congleton. Happy Dr. King Day. I hope that you've taken some time at some point today, whether you're working or our neighbors next door here at the rideshare, they had the day off. I just hope you've taken a few minutes. And I hope that you'll stick around. It's always a pleasure to have Bob Kim on this broadcast. Not only is he one of the smartest people I know, he's got a real gift when it comes to telling stories, whether through books or poetry. He reached out to me a couple days ago. A week from today is the 75th anniversary of the Allied liberation of Auschwitz. And he had written a poem about it. I had the pleasure of reading the poem today. We're going to get to that later in the hour. But I wanted Bob to be part of the Dr. King coverage today because it takes us in a different angle. Anyway, here's Bob Kim. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Dave. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming in. Any thoughts about Dr. King Day?
Well, you know, I was just remembering the one time I had an opportunity to hear him speak. It turned out to be aborted, and it's a story in itself. And it was 1967, so that would, and I believe it was April. It would have been about a year.
Yeah, he died in April 68.
Yeah, before he was assassinated. And there was a march against the war in Vietnam. People gathered in what was then called the Sheep Meadow in Central Park in New York. I was living in New York at the time. I think they call it Strawberry Fields now after John Lennon, right? Same place. So people gathered there. There was tens of thousands of people, and the march was going to go down 7th Avenue and across 42nd Street to the UN. And at the UN, King was going to speak out in the outdoors. And so I was with my best buddy and my sister-in-law, and we joined this march, and we marched down 7th Avenue. Suddenly found ourselves in the midst of a lot of black folks. My buddy, by the way, is a black fella. We became best friends when we were freshmen at Rutgers. And they were chanting, "Hell no, we won't go. Hell no, we won't go." And it was just echoing off of those, you know, off of that glass canyon going down 7th Avenue. Really, I don't think the hair laid down on my neck the whole time. We get to 42nd Street, we cross, we're walking towards the UN, and we get to this spot right near 1st Avenue where there is a bridge over 42nd Street. And the police, for God knows what reason, had erected barricades there. And there were police on horses there. And suddenly we were all packed in like sardines, whereas we had been marching, there was space, everybody was safe. And suddenly, for a reason I'll never understand, a policeman on a horse, a mounted policeman, broke through the barrier and rode into the crowd. And people started going down because we were packed so tight. It was terrifying. And all of us went down, literally, like dominoes. Fortunately, we weren't hurt. It took us at least 5 minutes for people to unbind themselves from this mess. And at that point, my sister-in-law was so traumatized by what had happened. You know, I looked at my buddy Bruce and I said, "I guess we better get out of here. You know, it's not safe." And Dr. King did go on and speak that day, but we did not get to hear him. And I wouldn't say that it's a regret of mine. I just think back on it and think it's a very weird little sidebar vignette to, you know, to his presence in the country. And I should say at the same time, I am not I have nothing against police officers. I have friends who are police officers. That was a bad day.
Had to be a very chilling moment.
It was chilling. It was traumatic. And I am sorry that I never got to see him speak live, but he certainly was one of the great inspirations of our lifetime.
Now, we're going to hear the poem after news at the bottom of the hour, but I want to talk about the inspiration. How did you decide to write a poem about Auschwitz?
Well, You know, it's funny, just my process in general is rather haphazard. Things just percolate out of the blue. And out of the blue, I was suddenly I was remembering meeting Elie Wiesel, who was, you know, the famous Holocaust survivor from Auschwitz, who wrote over 50 books, starting with, you know, Night, which is the book that Oprah recommended to everybody, the first book she recommended when she opened her book club. And in fact, she actually went to Auschwitz with Wiesel at one point. But I suddenly remembered, you know, that I had met Elie, and I'd never written anything about it. And he had such a powerful impact on me in what was probably about 2 hours in his presence. And, you know, at that point, I just started writing. And, of course, as you know, since you've read the poem, it brought up a memory of another Auschwitz survivor that I happened to meet when I was living in Israel in my early 20s, in the late, you know, 1969, 1970, right around then. And I'd never written anything about him. And I knew a little bit about his story. So, you know, at the moment that I started writing it, which was a couple of months ago, it wasn't even top of the mind that, oh, my gosh, the Holocaust commemoration is coming up in January. Wasn't even thinking about it. I just needed to write this poem.
All right. And so a week from today, we mark the 75th anniversary of what exactly?
Well, it was the liberation of Auschwitz. By, ironically, a Ukrainian brigade of the Russian army.
Really?
They were the ones who were in. Now they were on our side. You know, we were allies. Okay. So Auschwitz was January 27th. But Elie Wiesel was not there at that point. He was at Buchenwald. Because one of the things the Germans had done was they knew the Allies were coming. And they had taken a lot of the people out of Auschwitz and marched them, you know, out of Poland into Germany, to Buchenwald, where they obviously intended to, you know, to finish the job of murdering them all. And so Buchenwald was actually liberated on, I believe it was April 11th, 1945. So ironically, if Elie and his dad, who died a few days before the liberation of Buchenwald, if they had stayed in Auschwitz, they might have been liberated earlier, and his dad might have lived. So it's one of those things we'll never know.
You've been to Dachau?
I have been to Dachau.
Can you share at all what that experience is like to go to a concentration camp? Can you even begin to imagine what happened there?
Well, I mean, you try. You try to say something. I mean, that was Elie's mission, was to speak for the people that died who couldn't speak. And I certainly don't put myself in that, you know, in the same category as him. But it's difficult to describe. I mean, Dachau was the first concentration camp built. It was built in 1933. And
1933?
Yes, 1933. So a lot of these camps were built in the 30s. Now, Hitler had a plan. You know, he knew what he was about. There were ovens at Dachau, but they were never used. So not as many people died at Dachau as, for example, Auschwitz. The estimates are upwards of 1 million. Treblinka, the estimates are almost 1 million. Although it should be said that even some of the best researchers on this topic of the Holocaust and, you know, how many people really died, not just Jews, but Romanians, Gypsies, Catholics, Poles, you know, all these people who were the object of hate by the Nazi regime, the researchers don't have a high degree of confidence that they've got the numbers right. You know, so the Germans were very efficient with a lot of things, but in terms of keeping records of everybody they killed, I don't think they wanted to do that.
Yeah. Bob Kamm, on this broadcast, we're marking the approaching 75th anniversary of Auschwitz and the liberation of that concentration camp. We will pick up the conversation, and Bob will read the poem after news at the bottom of the hour. I'm Dave Congleton. You're listening to AM 920, FM 96.5, News Talk, KVEC.
Now back to Dave.
Just about 6:20 here on News Talk 920 KVEC. I'm in conversation with Bob Kam. We are talking about the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz in January.
January 27th, 1945.
I'm just looking here at the photos.
Mm.
The train track at Auschwitz led directly to the gas chamber.
Right, right. And over the entrance, the trains went right through this entrance, and over the entrance in German, it said, "Work will make you free." Talk about a deception.
The inmates were mainly Jews, Poles,
right,
Romanians, yeah, and Soviet prisoners of war.
Yes.
At one point, they had 1.3 million inmates. Mm. 1.1 million at least were killed.
Right. And as we were saying during the break, people have a hard time. You asked me what it was like being at Dachau. Dachau was relatively small compared to Auschwitz. Auschwitz occupied 472
acres. 472
acres. Acres dedicated to killing people, right?
And actually, that camp was a complex of over 40
yes,
concentration and extermination camps.
Right, right. So if you talk to somebody who is, you know, really more of an expert on this than I am, they will distinguish between a concentration camp and an extermination camp. Because there were camps that were exclusively dedicated just to killing people. There were other camps, you know, the Nazis had hundreds of camps spread all over Europe. There were camps that were more internment camps, where they literally concentrated people and held them there. But there were other camps that were specifically dedicated to murdering people. So, you know, Dachau being the first, but the ovens never being used there, it's painful to even try to describe. 28,000 people died there. That's the estimate. Only one is tempted in the face of a number as big as 6 million. One is tempted to say only 28,000 people. Only 28,000 people? I mean, there's no only. 28,000 human beings who had lives, you know, that they were ripped away from.
Those not gassed died of starvation, exhaustion, disease, individual right, executions or beatings.
Right.
Others were killed during medical experiments.
Right.
802 prisoners tried to escape.
Yeah.
144 successfully.
Yeah. Yeah. So in my poem, which I'll read shortly, I'm describing one of the ones who escaped. Now, I don't know if he's in that number, but it was well known he was on this kibbutz, this communal farm where I lived for almost 2 years in my early 20s. And you know, he somebody who would share his story if you asked him the right way. He escaped twice. Twice. The second time he made it out for good. So
Where do you come down on the debate that the Allies should have known about the atrocities sooner and should have done more?
Well, I'm not a historian. I'm not an expert on that stuff. But what I have read tells me that that's true, that there were a lot of people who turned away. A lot of the information was available as to what was going on. And, you know, they were doing nothing. You hear this when I was in Israel as a young man. I heard a lot of discussion about that. Remember, this was like 1969, 1970. It was roughly, you know, 25 years after the end of the war. There were a lot of people in Israel who were Holocaust survivors. And there was a lot of discussion about that. And that is why one of the mottos of the country is never again. So if you go to, in Israel, if you go to this archaeological site, Matsada, where this group of Jews held out for months against the Romans, the current government, current going back into the 60s, they made medallions that had images of Matsada, you know, this sort of huge mesa rising up on the edge of the Dead Sea, and there were the words in English and in Hebrew, "Never again." And there was this sense that you got, it wasn't a sense actually, I heard it from quite a few people that I had conversations with back then when I was like 22 years old, is the world doesn't care about Jews. The world didn't come to our rescue. And so we have got to protect ourselves. We've got to be the toughest guys on the planet.
And how do you react when you hear these stories about the younger generation coming along that don't have really any real idea of the Holocaust?
Well, I just think it's a failure of education and communication on the part of, you know, our system. I know this is not a happy topic to talk about, but as Elie Wiesel said over and over again, and other survivors have said, if you look away, if you refuse to talk about it, if you refuse to remember it, then you increase the possibility that it could happen again. You know, because there wasn't an early warning system, hey, the world wants to kill Jews again, because that early warning system didn't exist then, it should exist now because we know it can happen because it did happen, right? So I just think it's got to be an important part of education, and it's not just about the Jews. There have been other Holocausts as well. You know, the Armenians just come to mind, but, you know, my best buddy is a black fellow, and he uses the word Holocaust when he talks about what was done to black folks in this country. You know, that they were ripped out of their land and brought here and turned into non-humans. He calls it the Black Holocaust. I think that's a legitimate thing to call it. So all of this, you know, if we don't look at the shadow side, at the underbelly of humanity, then we will not be well prepared to head off future catastrophes. And I'm afraid to some degree we're seeing a lot of that right now because we have a huge catastrophe in like an increasingly building wave happening all over the planet. And we're not reacting, you know, as a species, we're not reacting with sufficient consciousness and speed.
Bob Kamm on this broadcast. And also, before the news break, you have a new book coming out shortly.
Well, not so shortly, but hopefully by May.
Well, shortly.
Yeah. And
Bob, that's 4 months away.
Okay, thank you. I guess I better get busy. Yeah. Now, I have all the poems and pieces selected, and this poem that I'm going to read after the break will be in that book. The book will be called The Magic Hour.
All right, Bob Kamm on this broadcast. Sounds like he'll be back in May once the book is actually out. What we are going to do is go to California Headline News and ABC Radio News. Craig will check time-saver traffic and weather together for us, and then Bob is going to read his poem. I also remind you that this Wednesday night we will continue our coverage of the March primary election, and we will have the debate between Ellen Bayrow and Debbie Arnold. That is going to be at the county supervisor chambers. We urge you, if you're going to go, get there early. That place was full by 6 p.m. Our live coverage will begin at 6 p.m. on Wednesday. Anyway, let's break away. We'll come back, hear the poem, continue the conversation. I urge you to stick around. This is Hometown Radio. All right, Craig, thank you. Don't forget to start tomorrow morning off with First Look. Andy Morrison, Scott Taylor have you covered with everything you need to know to get you out the door from 6 to 9 a.m., followed by Mr. Rush Limbaugh from 9 until noon, followed by the Mark Wilson Show, featuring our own Craig Hill from noon until 2. We give you a little dose of Dave Ramsey from 2 to 3, and then Craig and I will be back at 3:05 with a Tuesday edition of Hometown Radio. We are back in conversation with Bob Kamm. A week from today is the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. And Bob has spent a considerable time putting together this poem. It's called Ellie and the Blue Volvo. And I'm going to let Bob take it from here. He can introduce it anywhere he wants. The time is yours, sir.
Thank you. Ellie and the Blue Volvo. We were taking him from the airport to speak at a luncheon in downtown Cleveland. His presence in the back seat of my mother's blue Volvo sedan was at once weightless and ponderous. His name was Elie Wiesel. My cousin Danny sat beside him, chatting quietly. He was a student of Eli's, working his way through the Jewish holy books. He called Eli rabbi, teacher. And it was Danny who had arranged for today's speech. I sat in the front next to my mother. My body turned so I could study Eli. Although he wasn't the first person I'd met who'd survived Hitler's savagery. I'd been to Israel for nearly 2 years in the late 60s and early 70s. It was commonplace in those days to see people on buses in short-sleeved shirts with concentration camp numbers tattooed on their forearms. And then there was 40-something Chaim on the Galilean kibbutz, the communal farm where I was living. Chaim was called Chaimki, little Chaim, because he was barely 5 feet tall, though stout and surprisingly strong. His domain was the lul with chickens, where he would throw heavy bags of feed over his shoulder and chat with his creatures in barely audible Yiddish. Chaimki had a number on his arm, but he did not wear his nightmare or his survival on his sleeve, though he certainly had a story which he would tell if asked in a soft way, with respect, at the right moment, usually while tending his newly hatched chicks. He had escaped from Auschwitz twice at the age of 15, the second time for good, snatched from the darkness and the rabid Nazi fire by a Polish family, hidden till the end of the war. Escaping for good, to come to Israel, to marry, have a daughter, name her Devorah, raise chickens, live a quiet life under the Jewish night, for good, and tell his story from time to time, when asked in a soft way, with respect, in a moment when the air was still, when, for reasons I would never know, he could stand to recall the images, the feelings, the terror of being shot and falling into a ditch beneath so many other machine-gunned Jews, only to discover he was alive, the bullet having passed through the flesh above his hip. And so, in darkness, he climbed from the gash in the ground filled with bodies, a gash that was not to be covered over until morning, so much for German efficiency. He climbed out from under the dead who had saved his life, climbed out and tunneled under the fence like a furious dog, ran for the woods and a flickering light with a pounding wish for shelter, for kindness, for life. Escape that place for good, that place for which there were no words to describe the smell of fear and sweat and last breaths, no words for dead eyes fixed on a godless sky. He would tell this story, sometimes while tending his chicks, if asked in a soft voice, with respect and hesitancy, but a yearning to know. Tell it with wonder on his face, as if he still couldn't believe nearly 3 decades later that the world had grown claws and fangs and hungered for Jewish blood, and still couldn't believe he had actually escaped that land that dwelled so far beyond the frontiers of terror and desperation. But mostly, Chaimki just lived, with energy, even effervescence, and talked about his daughter, or his wife, or the beauty of the kibbutz community, or the best feed for his chicks, or how many stars you could see on a moonless night here in the Jewish land. But Eli, in the back seat of my mother's blue Volvo sedan, Eli was different. He wore a long-sleeved shirt, jacket, and tie, his numbered arm hidden, but only his arm, not his anguish. Cavernous anguish, in the lines descending from the corners of his nose. Cavernous anguish, in the lines between his eyebrows and in his dark pupils. Cavernous anguish, like the gaping mouths of the dead, filled with night and fire. For though he was also 15 when captive, he had not escaped like Chaimki, but had suffered the claws, the fangs, the hunger for Jewish blood at Auschwitz and Buchenwald, where his father had withered into death. And then, beyond all hope, Ellie had been liberated before a gash in the ground or a gas chamber or machine gun, rifle butt or bayonet, dysentery or starvation could end him. At the luncheon, he rose to speak, and I might have been forgiven for expecting the thunderous voice of God to blast from his lips for all he had experienced and witnessed. But that was not Ellie. Soft tones, sometimes barely audible, flowed from him like hot honey. But within his voice, riding a wet, dark wind from far behind him, came many voices, voices within voices, all audible, voices within voices, anguish within anguish, filling every inch of the ballroom. His mission, to speak for those who endured the unspeakable and could not tell their stories. And the warning implicit in them that this could happen again, though it might look different. But the human race has not been inoculated from this rampaging disease of cruelty. His mission filling the room, dark wind, dark waters rushing in until all of us, the audience, the servers and busboys, all of us were gasping for air, tears etching our cheeks like streaks of ash from a falling sky. On the way back to the airport, once again, Cousin Danny sat with Ellie in the back seat of my mother's blue Volvo. I sat in the front, turned so I could see him. His face transfixed me. Danny once again addressed him as Rabbi and asked a question about a Talmudic passage. Ellie answered him with patience and affection in his soft, near-whispering voice. I was astonished he could travel in a matter of minutes from the incomprehensible murders of Auschwitz and Buchenwald to the back seat of the Volvo to answer my cousin's question. And I thought, his heart has been shattered. Shattered. And still, he loves. How is that possible? It has been nearly 50 years since that day. Ellie is gone. My mother is gone. Her blue Volvo is long gone. And yet recently, I have seen them. Ellie, Mom, the Volvo. As I've seen stories of entire people exiled from their land. Stories of parents and children treated as parasites, separated and caged. Stories of bullets spraying through malls, open-air markets, weddings, nightclubs, concerts, schools, churches, synagogues. The rapacity of the Nazis returning, only clothed differently and media savvy. And I have seen them floating through images of the Amazon screaming, the glaciers screaming, the coral screaming, hurricanes, tornadoes, and droughts screaming, whole species vanishing, everywhere throats full of rage amidst the stupid, deaf malevolence of mankind against itself and everything around it. Images of a world that cannot be escaped for a greater good, as Heimke had from Auschwitz. I see the blue Volvo floating by like a ghost ship, in the middle of these stories, my mom behind the wheel, and Ellie in the back seat, gazing through the window, eyes so forlorn and yet so compassionate, hands pressed against the glass, his anguished lips moving, but his words inaudible for all the screaming in the world. My body bends toward him, yearning for his voice and the voices within his voice and the stories that might teach us, make us better against all odds. I tremble for humanity, run to an empty beach as far from the screaming images as possible. I scan the blue skies for glimpses of God and find only absence and silence. But here, on this beach, at least I can remember. I can remember being in the front seat of my mother's blue Volvo on the way to the Cleveland airport, transfixed by Ellie, who has traveled from Auschwitz and Buchenwald in a matter of moments, as he answers my cousin's questions with such patience, such warmth. And I can remember thinking, as if it were happening right now, his heart has been shattered, shattered, and still he loves. How is that possible? How is that possible?
Bob Kamm on Hometown Radio, reading his new poem, Ellie and the Blue Volvo. Welcome back. I'm Dave Congleton. This is Hometown Radio. Top of the hour, it's ABC Radio News. I'm Dave Congleton. We're in our final segment with Bob Kamm. I got to ask, how that was the first time you've read that in public?
Yes.
How do you feel? What is it like to go into those memories and those emotions and have to go public with it? I can't imagine doing that.
Well, I'm really grateful for the question, because I don't think anybody's ever asked me that. So, you know, art is an experience of vulnerability, among other things, right? So, I mean, every artist sort of makes their stand in their own way. And for me, this gives me an opportunity to be quintessentially myself, I guess. And it's scary to share that much feeling. It's scary to put it out there. And yet it's very satisfying. So
off the Stolberg Law KVC text line, Kathy writes in, "Oh my God, that poem was amazing."
Oh, thank you, Kathy. Thank you. Well, as I said, I'm very grateful to you, because you've always given me an opportunity to share. And, you know, I don't put words on paper to stick in a drawer someplace. I want to share them.
Why was it important to put these words on paper?
Well, so a part of writing is a process of discovering myself and what is meaningful to me, that I think might be meaningful to other people. Because ultimately, what I, you know, I'm still doing my leadership retreats, and what I say to people is that life is not about being happy, it's about meaning. And if your life is meaningful, then you can get through all kinds of things that are not happy and still feel validated, still feel strong, still feel like yourself. So for me, you know, that's what this is about. I don't start a poem with the whole thing fully formed. You know, I never do that. It's almost as if I've got a thread and I start pulling it, or I see a few stepping stones and I start walking, and I don't know where it's going to take me exactly. Right?
Did you have relatives die in the Holocaust?
Oh yeah. Most of I don't have. I mean, my family tree was truncated at two generations. So,
and have you taken upon yourself to learn their stories? Is that important to you?
My cousin Danny, that I mentioned in the poem, he's still alive, and he has done his best. He took this on at a very young age, so I just encouraged him and said, let me know if I can do anything. But he never really needed any help. He basically found the names, and he found a picture of a whole family of about a dozen people who would have been great-grandparents to me, and maybe even great-great-grandparents. But we were never able to get stories. We never got them. There was one branch of the family that escaped to Israel before the Holocaust, And, you know, I spent time with them when I was in Israel. And I have a cousin who's a little bit younger than I am, Adiah. And I still occasionally communicate with her. But none of us, you know, I mean, this is the thing that people don't realize. Some folks can go back 500, 600, 700 years into their family tree. And they have wonderful stories, history, whatever, that they can tap into and have a sense of all these rivers flowing into them, all these precursors of who they were. And if you are a Jewish person in the world, the odds are that you just don't have much of a family tree.
So what does it mean to you to be Jewish?
you got another hour?
Yeah.
That's a very good question. Let me say first, I am not a religious Jew. I was raised...
But weren't you at one point?
No, never really. I was raised in what is known as a Reformed Jewish community, which my cousin, who was very conservative, they hardly considered us Jews because we were not very devout. But for me, it is a cultural identity. Now, I consider myself more an American than anything. But within being an American, I think it means that there are certain cultural traditions that have flowed into me from my parents and grandparents and the people before them back in the shadows of time that I will never get to know about. And part of that is a profound and active curiosity about life, a gratitude about life, a valuing of learning. You know, there's an old joke, but the Jews are always asking questions. So the old joke is, you know, a non-Jew says to a Jewish guy, why do you Jews ask so many questions? And the Jew responds, why shouldn't we? Is there something wrong with that? Is there another way? What would you do? You know? So we question a lot. We question authority. We believe in, you know, the professions, right? Whether it's, you know, law or medicine or teaching or, you know, whatever. And we definitely believe in the arts and we believe in giving back. So that's part of the cultural identity.
Off the Stolberg Law KVC text line, I also agree the poem was absolutely incredible. Almost cried a couple times.
Oh. Thank you. Who was that?
I don't have a name.
No name. Well,
praying that God gives you strength to keep going.
Oh, thank you. Well, whoever you are, thank you for that.
Why poetry as opposed to memoir? What does poetry give you to get the message across that you want?
It's a short form that requires extreme concentration of truth and feeling for me. And I just love that, and I can't tell you why, except that, you know, I grew up with a father who was a journalist, who, you know, he had journalism. He had staked that out. So he did that. I wasn't going to go there. I had no desire to follow in his footsteps in that sense, but he cultivated this love of language in me. And again, I think it's a short form that requires a really, really deep dive in order to try to tap into essence and to refine the language so that it comes across. I mean, you know this about me. I really don't like poetry that's obtuse, that uses weird, you know, we used to call them 35-cent words, now $35 words. I don't really like that. I don't like poetry that refers to a lot of Greek mythology and stuff like that that, you know, most people probably don't know anything about. So I'm trying to reach a wider audience, and I love the challenge of trying to distill essence in the fewest possible words and yet tell the story of my feelings and my experience.
So the good news is that sometime later this year, there's going to be a new collection out by Bob Camp.
Yes. Yes, it'll be my sixth book, the fourth collection of poetry. I hope anybody who liked the poem would go on Amazon and just put my name in, and they'll find Lyric Heart or Love Over 60 or Gazing. And then this will be called The Magic Hour.
And Bob spells his last name K-A-M-M.
Correct.
As Bob Camp puts together a final thought, let me take a minute and thank our guest today. Nice show. I'm very pleased we're able to offer you all these segments on the Martin Luther King holiday. Thanks to Christopher Lambert and Dennis Mahon for talking about Kristen Smart. Thank you to Mary Matakovich and Mike Clark from the Martin Luther King Scholarship Fund. Thanks to Bex McVeigh and Danielle Borelli. We're talking about the second annual Human Trafficking Summit. Thanks to Dr. James Papp and Dr. John Ashbaugh for previewing the city council meeting tomorrow night. Please make your voices heard on this issue. Special thanks to Bob Kemp for coming in and sharing his wonderful writing with us. Bob, I got about 45 seconds for a final thought, sir.
Okay. Two things quickly. My Facebook page is just Bob Kam. I invite people to go there. I will be posting my own video of the poem soon. George Santayana was the one who said, those who do not learn from history are condemned to repeat it. And so I would simply say to anybody in the audience who finds this to be a very, very painful subject, it is, and we should look at it. We should not turn away from it. We should learn from it.
All right, sir. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you.
Off we go. We've got ABC Radio News and then Our American Stories. Stick around and enjoy that. Thanks to Craig Hill for his help, as always, and thanks to all my guests, and thank you for listening. Have a great night. We'll see you tomorrow at 3:05. I'm Dave Congleton. Thank you for listening. Now, Oliver, the cat, get out of my chair. Really, get out of my chair. I'm coming home. Good night.